Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss different issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual, or in this case, transgender man. If you have any comments you'd like to make during the broadcast, please feel free to email me at bonkay@aol.com, that's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E, at aol.com. Before I introduce my special guest for this evening, I just want to make an announcement that I'm reminding people that in just a few months we'll be having our California Healing Weekend. It's going to be a wonderful, wonderful weekend filled with surprises and guest speakers that will really make a difference in your moving forward with your healing. So it's going to be in Orange County, California, and it's the weekend of April 13th and 14th. We'll have women from all over the country and from out of the country also coming this time. So there's no charge for the weekend except for a food charge, and we have a great group waiting at a beautiful, beautiful hotel outside the John Wayne Airport in Southern California, Orange County. So if you're interested in getting more information, just write to me at bonkay@aol.com. And in the subject box, you can put Healing Weekend. Well, tonight we're going to welcome back a very special guest who's done wonderful things in the field of healing and who's a really amazing woman to me who I've had the opportunity to meet and work with over the last few years. Her name is Alexa Servidio. Alexa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be back on, Bonnie. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's always such a pleasure, and our listeners always get so much information out, you know, when you're on the show, first of all, about why they're feeling the way they feel when they're going through healing and different steps they can take along their journey of healing. And one of the things I do want to mention is that you are a clinical social worker, so you're always working with people who are in abusive situations. That's something that you really focus on. And you also have a beautiful book out. It's been out for, you know, about how long? About 2 years now?
Yeah, two and a half years, yes.
And it's an amazing book called Finding Your Peace Within the Chaos. And if anybody lives in chaos, Alexa, it's women that are part of this network whose lives are always in turmoil because they're living with something that they don't understand, why things are going so poorly, blaming themselves because they're led to believe that there is nothing wrong except in our own minds by husbands who just won't be honest with us and who can never be husbands to us because of the fact that they are gay and they don't belong in a straight marriage. And they're just trying to fake it to the best of their ability. And in doing so, really do tremendous harm, you know, to their wives and to their families. So one of the things that I wanted you to really discuss, give me some help with here, is that women say that the reason they linger in these marriages so long, even after they find out, is because they hesitate because of the children to break up a family. And of course, I'm understanding and sympathetic, but I also believe that children, when they're growing up in a toxic situation, this is more harmful than being in a different situation when you're just with one parent. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I agree with you completely. I know it's a very hard decision to make to leave a marriage, number one, and two, add children into the equation makes it even more harder. But I think bringing up the issue of being toxic, if there's abuse, emotional, physical, verbal abuse, it's important not for your children to be in that type of environment. And I've said so many times, a lot of adults don't believe the children hear it or they're too young to understand it, but they do hear it and they perceive it with their own perceptions that it has something to do with them and that something's wrong with them. I think living with that underlying chaos, that underlying tension in the house where you can almost cut it with a knife, yes, you might not see it, but I think we've all been in that situation where we've walked into a room and our gut and our senses said, okay, there's a lot of tension going on in this room with these people. Imagine a child growing up and being in that type of environment.
And I think that's so true because I can recall when I was the child, probably at the age of 5 or 6, and I had a brother who was 2 years younger than I was, and my parents would fight at nighttime. They would always wait till we went to bed. But then the verbal fighting began. And one accusation, now I didn't know exactly what they were arguing over, but it always reverted back at some point to hearing my name and my brother's name. Because when there was nothing they could hit each other with, then it became fighting over the children. And it was almost on a daily basis, but they always felt that nobody would hear what they're saying because we would be sleeping. But we weren't sleeping, and I grew up always feeling a sense of panic that I was the cause of my parents' unhappiness. And I think that happens in a lot of cases. Would you say it does?
Yes. And what you just said, you grew up with that sense of panic, and that's what it becomes. If the child consciously or subconsciously recognizes that, it's that underlying feeling of something's not right, I don't know what exactly it is, something's wrong with mommy and daddy. And in any situation, for a child to believe something's wrong with their mother and father, or they're upset or physical danger, is very upsetting for a child and really damages them through their life as they grow up with that underlying panic and fear.
And also, it sets a bad example for later on in their own lives, because as I tell women, children model themselves after you. If you're willing to stay in a marriage or relationship where someone's abusing you, either emotionally, not necessarily physically, but mentally, and constantly battering you or, you know, gaslighting you, and children see this going on, then when they grow up, they're going to expect nothing more for themselves because their abnormal will become their normal. And I believe they truly are more of prey for people out there who are looking for weak people or people they can control or dominate. Do you think that's a factor in that too?
Oh, yes. They build up a tolerance for unhealthy behaviors, for screaming, for insults. They're able to, the next day, you know, as mom and dad do, everything's going to be okay. So that's what they learn growing up. And they can also be able to let other people get away with certain things that normally people wouldn't let them get away with. And they start to become immune to the words, to the violence, and to the screaming.
I agree 100%. And I tell that to women, that if your daughter came to you and, you know, or your sister came to you and said, I want to marry a guy just like Dad, would you tell them, go ahead, I'm happy for you? And in no cases does anyone ever say yes to me. They said no. I would tell them to run, don't look back, and keep going. So I say to them, how can you expect your daughter to do something that you won't do? If it's good enough for your daughter, why isn't it good enough for you? If you would tell her, leave and run the other way, why can't you leave and run the other way and at least be an example for her? And that's how I feel that children learn from the way their parents pattern their lives. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and it also puts your children in a position as they're growing up to be a target. I was recently watching a talk show with Dr. Phil, and it was on a different type of topic of people who, you know, who for overseas try to scam money out of people here in America. And they
said,
yeah,
I saw that the other day.
Their screening process was they would see how much that person, the victim, would agree to, who would take, would kind of just let go by as if it was bad grammar, bad, you know, punctuation, broken English. And the more this person would not say, okay, something's not right, what's going on, why are you asking such personal questions, they knew they had one that would fall for all their behaviors and their games. And I think this transfers over to what we're talking about. These predators are looking around, lurking, waiting to find somebody who they can interact with like this. And they fish. It's a fishing game where they find out to see how much they can get away with the other person. And I think if a child is growing up in one of these environments, they're sort of, it's normalized to be called all different names, to be woken up in the middle of the night and screamed at and told you're no good. And then the next day everybody sits at the table having breakfast, behaving like nothing happened the night before.
And I think you're so right with that, because this is why I feel that many of the women who are part of our support network, and I've worked with thousands upon thousands upon thousands over the years, and, you know, 35 years I'm doing this, and this is such a large problem in our society. But most of them, I really do believe, were vulnerable, suffering from something when they got into these marriages. In other words, they could have had abuse at home when they were growing up, neglect. Many of them just felt very unloved. There could have been mental illness in the family. Some of them dealt with that. Some of them dealt with alcoholism and drug addiction in the family with their parents. So they never felt validated, and they never felt strong about themselves because they didn't have supportive, nurturing parents. So naturally, when somebody comes along with a gimmick or a line, you know, and there are a lot of sociopathic, narcissistic men out there promising to love you and to cherish you, then it's very easy to fall for that kind of, you know, personality, definitely a personality disorder, but they know how to reel you in. And once they have you reeled in, then that's all it takes for them to do that. They have you. And, you know, at first it seems very nice because you feel really wanted and loved, and some guy is telling you all these beautiful things about you that you've always wanted to hear but never heard. And so it's very easy to get fooled by their kindness or their, you know, sayings of love. Because I watched the same show with Dr. Phil the other day, and this woman was an educated woman. She was becoming a licensed therapist. And she was taken, and he said, like, put yourself outside this box and look in, which is what I always tell women. Look, pretend you're standing on the outside looking in. Do you see a happy person inside that marriage? And if you don't, you never have to feel that you're trapped and you can't move. You just have to have a game plan that takes time. But one of the things I tell women, maybe you could discuss this a little bit, Alexa, as long as you're living in an abusive situation where you're being mentally beaten down or physically beaten down, you know, you talk about your book as, you know, about healing from the chaos, but how can you ever heal while you're living in the chaos? I tell them you have to get out first. That's from my opinion. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I agree. I feel when I work with women who are in a domestic violence situation or a verbal, emotionally abusive relationship and they're not ready to leave, they a lot of times ask questions, how can I deal with this? How can I not take this so to heart what this person is doing? And I said, well, I can't numb you out. You're a human being. I cannot make you a person that doesn't feel what these horrible things are being done to you. I said, what we have to work on is crisis. It's survival. You're just going to be living in survival mode. The mind and the body mm-hmm. cannot begin to start healing because it still senses danger emotionally or physically. So you really can't start to begin that healing because you can't even start the forgiveness process, if that's even in your mind and so an option for someone, until you've removed yourself from the situation, stepped back, stayed out of the situation, aren't able to see what it is really that is going on, and also to look at your sense of self and also look at yourself and realize you don't deserve to be treated like that.
Mm-hmm. And once a woman gets out of a negative situation or toxic situation, then I believe the healing process can start. And for some people, it's going to be a long process, because in our marriages, and I really feel they're totally different than any other kind of marriage, because you didn't have the information going in what this marriage was going to be about. And in most cases, the men who marry you, they've had either some experience with some kind of sexuality issue, whether it's being, you know, not directly, well, different levels of what they've done before they get into the marriage. And then once they're in the marriage, they're really not interested in you as a woman because they are gay men. And gay men are not looking to have sexual relationships with women. So, first of all, it knocks down your total sense of sexual esteem, which I feel is so important as a woman, to not be told constantly that you're needy or that you're a nymphomaniac or you don't smell good or your breath is bad. You know, 52 reasons why they don't want to have sex with you and make you feel like it's your fault. So that's the slow deterioration of feeling who you are as a woman. And if you get slapped down enough times, you don't feel like asking anymore because you know you're going to be told something that's not very nice. So these marriages don't start off on the right foot to start with. And then the men who are so frustrated living with you because they feel you're the jailkeeper keeping the key to their happiness in tow, even though they wanted to marry you. But now that they did and they realize this is really not what it's about for them, you know, they become very cruel sometimes and very humiliating. And even what, and I guess this is what a lot of our women don't understand, maybe you could give us some insight on this. Even when these marriages are over, a lot of times these men are not nice at all. And they'll do whatever they can to trip you up or to maybe get child support or spousal support where it's legal. You know, they'll look for every way to get out of it. And sometimes it's just a power struggle where they want to keep the children. They didn't have any particular interest with them before. But now all of a sudden they're trying to take your children away. Have you run across that in other marriages, though?
Yes, many, many times. And I believe it's also, it's the power control. That's the only power they have over you. And it wasn't horrible enough that your marriage was a fraud because they were not interested in having a relationship with a woman. Two, they gave you a definition of what love was, which is dysfunctional, and had you sort of hit, you know, you sort of become brainwashed into believing, emotionally, physically beaten down, that you start accepting this dysfunctional definition. And then the perpetrator usually has so much self-hatred, self-loathing towards themselves, they acted out on the person that loves them, the person that is so hurt and is the one who's the victim, but they almost find a joy or a piece of being able to inflict that pain on the other person because it helps them release all the pain that they have towards themselves and the anger.
And I think you're so right on that whole answer, Alexa, because many times when you hear these men say, well, we didn't try to trick anybody, we were just victims of society because of the way society feels about homosexuality, so we had to do this to protect ourselves. But in other words, you don't want to be hurt because you don't want to be a victim of society, but you're very willing to bring somebody in who's innocent and has no knowledge and make her a victim as well. So to me, that argument just doesn't go anymore. I mean, I'm sympathetic and I am understanding, but at the same time, you know, if you know what you are and you're not being honest with a woman, that's, I believe, the worst thing you can do for her. And it's just like you said before, how children always know they're in a toxic situation. These men are always saying, and this is what bothers me, Well, there were other problems in the marriage besides this. Well, yeah, there's going to be other problems in the marriage when you're married to somebody who doesn't want you. You weren't the problem to start with. I mean, but you went into the marriage under false pretenses, and naturally they're going to become a problem. Do you agree with that?
Yes, because there's already a dysfunction in the marriage. There's already a lie, an elephant in the room that one person or both people might know about. And I think that's where it becomes, it almost becomes, okay, we don't want other people to really realize this is what it is, so we start finding other excuses, other things, other ways. As I find a lot of times when I'm doing couples therapy and one of the significant others is cheating, and they'll come up with 15 excuses. They made me do it. She never supported me. He always said I didn't look good, and I gained too much weight, so I had to seek. No, that was your decision. Yes, what that person did could have been very cruel, but that was your decision to step out of the marriage. That was your decision, bringing it back, to not tell your spouse, hey, I don't know what's going on, but I've been having these feelings. Do you still want to be married to me? Do you still want to go through with this marriage? Give the person the other option. As long as you're honest with your doubt, with your confusion, that's okay. But you have to let the other person know what they're getting. Just as in life, if we buy something that's supposed to be A, B, and C, and we take it home and it's not that, we're allowed to bring it back. That's fraud. That's false pretenses that we were sold that. Same thing in a marriage. You can't expect someone just to say, okay, I'm going to accept it, even though that's not what I signed up for.
And the problem also that I say is that even if women have some knowledge before time, it's very confusing, because especially today, when I was growing up, it was a little different. But today, there's so much information out there saying that, well, sexuality is fluid, and people are doing people of all kinds in all cases. And so sometimes somebody will say, well, yeah, when I was younger, you know, I tried it, I didn't like it. And that's what I was told when I, you know, was going with somebody. I was told exactly that. I wasn't sure what I was, so I experimented around, and I realized that I liked women. And that would sound like a logical explanation of why somebody gay is marrying you, even though you don't realize he's gay. You just think that he experimented. So I think that with our limited knowledge, thinking that, well, whatever the problem was, I can fix it. I'll make sure he doesn't think about gay because I'll be the best wife ever. Not realizing that even if you do know something about it, you don't really understand homosexuality and how it's just not something that goes away. It's not something you take a pill and the next day you're going to wake up straight. It's something that's always going to be there, and it's only a matter of time before your spouse either acts on it, or there are a few men, I believe, who are not acting on it, but they're just so miserable and unhappy, and it takes its whole toll on the whole family unit. So even though I do agree with you, honesty would be best, because at least you have a hint of what's going wrong, so that even if you make the mistake and get married, at least when things are going downhill, you can say, well, that's not what I understood was going to happen. And I realize now that there's no way for me to stop this runaway train, as I like to call it, because it's just running off the track and you're never going to catch up with it and you can't stop it. It's just going to keep running along. So, and I think the same thing, maybe you can talk a little bit about personality disorders, because a lot of our women are married to men who are very narcissistic. Can you explain that a little bit, the definition there?
Yes, a lot of times with personality disorders, I think your listeners really have to understand this, because I went to a seminar a few years back with someone who was a personality specialist, disorder specialist. And what he said, people with the personality disorders have a void. A void doesn't mean that they can be taught these feelings. They can be taught how to feel empathy. They can be taught how to feel, oh, I feel bad, I hurt that person, or to put someone before them. It's a void. They never knew that feeling, so it's not in them. So many times women will believe that I can just teach him. He will learn how to love me. He will learn this way. I will do everything perfect. It's so hard because that person, there's a void to it. They learn to mimic behaviors in order to get desired reactions. And that's where the narcissist, sociopath are so dangerous, is that they're able to mimic what they know the other person will say, yes, that's normal. This person loves me. This person feels bad for what they've done, but they lack those emotions. They lack remorse, empathy. They don't realize between right and wrong. It's about how do I survive and how do I get by. And a lot of times it's all about them. They don't care about hurting other people's feelings as long as they meet their needs. And I think this brings back to what you were saying before. And now, day and age, everything is so fluid with sexuality, which I think in some people, if you're a consenting adult and you're single, you're allowed to explore those things. But I think they're introducing this to such young children that they're trying things a lot of times that they don't even understand. And I think that's where the danger is, where everything is okay to try as long as you feel good about it. And we're raising these generations of, as long as it makes me feel good, yes, if it hurts someone else, I'm sorry, but I put me first. It's always about me. And that's what the narcissist is about.
Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of that in these marriages because, first of all, they don't belong there. So, second of all, they have to take care of their needs somehow. So their needs always are first. And I think a lot of times the women who are in these marriages, and I'm the first to raise my hand, we're really the empaths of the world. We're the people who are the fixer-uppers. And we feel sorry for these men because they, like you say, they mimic other people and they make you feel sorry for them. They'll all tell you what a rough life they've had, how their families never treated them right. And I know that's how I got sucked into that marriage with my gay husband. Was the fact that, you know, he was very charming. I met him at a time in the 1970s, the late 70s. He looked like Sylvester Stallone, and he had beautiful personality, very funny, very charming. And I fell for him. I was smitten by him. But in time, I realized that things weren't right. But I also knew that he came from a bad family and that he'd had a hard time growing up in that family unit. And so I always felt that I could fix it. If I show him enough love, he's going to understand what love really means. If he sees that I support him in every possible way, then he's going to be, you know, able to be a complete human being. And I'm going to be able to solve his problems. And that's, you know, how it was for me. But that doesn't work. You can't fix these people because it is a personality disorder. And a personality disorder is not like an illness or mental health issue. Because if you have mental health issues, you work in mental health, you know, you can give people medication to, you know, kind of change some of the symptoms or problems they're having. But there is no medication for this, am I correct?
Well, there's medications to keep it in check, but there's no medication to teach them how to feel or to get those feelings that they never had. A lot of times they will go to DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, which will teach them to regulate their mood, regulate their emotions, and also to kind of look at their behaviors before acting on them so they can survive in society and they can somewhat not damage everybody that comes in their path. That doesn't mean they've changed, that they've turned into this other person. That means they realized, hey, I better do something because I'm going to lose my job, or I'm not going to be able to make the money that I made, or I'm going to lose my children, or I'm going to go to jail, or I'm going to have to pay child support. There's an incentive to learn how to adjust their behaviors so they can have a better outcome. It's not for the victim or for those around them. It's for them and their selfish need.
So in other words, you know, you can change behaviors like through behavior modification. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to change who you really are. It means that you learn how to cope, you know, how to behave better, how not to break out in tantrums or to always feel you have to have your way. But I don't think it necessarily means that you're internally changing. Is that true?
Yes. Internally, you still will have those gut feelings. You will still have those reactions, those irrational beliefs, those irrational emotions. But you don't have the same ability as someone who does not have narcissism or different personality disorders to be able to say, okay, well, this is going to cause pain. If someone did that to me, my feelings would be hurt. I don't want to see this person suffer. They're missing that connection in their brain. That's not there. That can't be taught. It's void. It's missing. So that's what you have to really know what you're dealing with.
What's your theory on how people develop these personality disorders? Are they born, nurture? What is your thought?
They say that there's both, but I have found with a lot of the clients that I've worked with who have been narcissists and also family members of narcissists, that the narcissist has gone through either severe abuse or severe neglect to the point where during their childhood, when those emotions, those developmental stages were supposed to be encouraged by their parents in a safe environment, teaching a child to explore and not either be totally abandoned or the parent be very angry and aggressive with them, that child never developed that skill, never developed that stage, so they never had it. So that's why it's so hard for these people to really understand what's going on. It was never part of them.
Uh-huh.
And it can start, as they say, as a baby. They always say there's, you know, different types of mothers. There's the mother that doesn't come to the child when it's crying. And after many, many, not just, you know, I know mothers leave children at night sometimes and you have to let them cry because you can't run to them every 5 minutes. But neglect to the point where you never run to that child when the child is hungry, when the child has wet themselves. That child starts to say, when I cry, nobody comes. No one's here. And that even though it's an infant, they start to realize it. Or when I cry, mommy or daddy come and they're angry and they yell and there's always tension and I can tell they don't. The child can sense that. So it's all different types of starting when there's an infant and going through those early stages. That's how children, what parents are doing around their children really impacts them.
I agree, because I think for a while, I grew up with a father who was a sociopath, who passed away a couple of years ago. But he was really severe and very charming. He seemed very loving because I didn't understand as a child what love really meant. And, you know, he'd had some very bizarre behaviors. And that's what I grew up with. And I loved my daddy because he was always, you know, my best friend, because he couldn't really develop real friendships with people. So whenever he did something that I thought was funny, instead of saying, no, that's not funny, that's not the way we do things, he was doing things that were ridiculous, and I just kept laughing and thinking they're funny because he told me they were funny. So I think I tended to take on some of those behaviors when I was younger before I knew the difference between right and wrong. And it took me time to learn that this is not correct behavior or what I'm doing is hurtful, even if it was just to myself. You know, you have to wake up at some point if you're not like that and say, you know what, I can change this. I don't want to be that way. But I think a true narcissist or sociopath would never be able to say that, because I think they're happy with who they are. This is the only life they know, and they don't have the capacity to understand. So I think sometimes that you're role modeling when you're younger. If you come from parents like that, you have all kinds of issues when you get older. And you really are vulnerable for people who are the predators in life. We're looking to seek out people who are weak, who they can control, who they can rip off, who they can use, because a lot of these people are just users, using you for their own convenience. And never caring whether or not you're going to be happy, that's not one of their concerns. Their only concern is if they're going to be happy. And I find that happening a lot. But going back to your book, Ending Your Peace Within the Chaos, I would like to address a few things you have in your book and maybe to talk a little bit about them. So your book covers a lot of really great issues as far as people and problems that they're having. So one of the problems that our children have, so I'm thinking about this more from a child's perspective, because I think children come from this kind of dysfunction. They do all kinds of things, and your book starts off about kids who are doing cutting, and I've had a number of parents say that their kids are doing that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. A lot of times when there's cutting behavior, it's often confused with suicide attempt and anything to do with suicidal. Yes, there's times where they interlap, but there is a difference between cutting behaviors and suicide ideation and suicide attempts. Both are very serious and both need to be addressed immediately. But a lot of times when I find I have a child or an adolescent that is cutting, I like to explore if there was any bullying, physical abuse, sexual abuse, or an eating disorder, because I find they all seem to go hand in hand. It's almost a triad to some degree. And why the cutting becomes such an unhealthy tool for this person is it's a way for them to release their emotional pain or to have control over their emotional pain, or for some children, some women have said, to actually be able to know that they're alive, that they can feel pain. And I think it's sometimes so disturbing and confusing for someone who has not been exposed to cutting behaviors or have any education on it, that why would someone ever want to hurt themselves? But again, going back to living in a dysfunctional home where there's abuse, where there's addiction, those children can't find a way out. They can't handle all the emotional, physical pain that is going on. Their little minds can't grasp it. Adult minds can't grasp it. So the only way they can start releasing it is with these acting out behaviors, is cutting themselves. And they can cut themselves on their wrists, on their arms, on their inner thighs, on their stomach, between their toes, depending what season it is. I've also had a lot of clients that self-harm to the way where they scratch themselves, and it looks like, oh, they, you know, the cat scratched me. But what they do is when there's fighting at home with their parents or bullying at school, or their body or mind feel that there's a stressful situation, they start scratching their hands to the point, if you look at them after a couple of minutes, their hands are bleeding. They're digging their nails in. And it's not just a regular scratch. It's very disturbing to watch.
Terrible. But that's an interesting thought that you just brought up, that this is not necessarily related to suicide, which I always thought that in some way it might be. And maybe it is, but not necessarily so. I'm just curious, did you hear anything much about cutting before the past few years? Because I really never heard about it when I was growing up.
I've heard it throughout the years as, you know, a way of children just seeing a friend do it, or someone told them about it, or they, you know, by accident cut themselves and then kept cutting afterwards. But it's been around for a very long time. I believe people just didn't really want to discuss it because it's such a tough topic, number one. And two, I think a lot of times the people hide it well. The children, the adolescents, adults, they hide it well. And a lot of times you can see where I have a lot of clients where in the summertime, when they're wearing a tank top and shorts, their arms, wrists, and inner thighs look like they've been in a knife fight. And that's happened when they were younger children, just from cutting. They might have not even needed stitches, but it was so many years that the scars are there.
So in a situation like that, how do you treat it?
One, I make a safety contract. I want to also explore, too, is there any suicidal ideation? Because one of the dangers, though, with cutting, even if there isn't suicide ideation, is you cut yourself so many times, one of those times you're going to hit a main artery or a vein or do something lethal to yourself. It's a horrible numbers game. But I want to also find out, what is their intention? What is their goal when they cut? And then figure out, how can I give them a healthier option to release or to feel whatever they need to feel without them harming themselves? And it's also helping them define their sense of self. A lot of times these young people don't even have a sense of self, or they have a dysfunctional sense of self. So they're very confused of what they deserve. And a lot of times I've had clients tell me they don't deserve people to be nice to them. They don't deserve ever to be happy. Other people get those things, but they just will never deserve it, and they just have to take that as that's their part of life, that they're not worthy.
Well, let me ask you this. If somebody is cutting when they're younger, does this lead to other psychological problems when they're older?
Yes. I definitely believe it can if it's not treated. Because, again, it's an unhealthy defense mechanism, a coping skill, able to deal with whatever problem is going on. And then that person is growing up as an adult, uses other ones, or keeps on cutting, or uses alcohol, drugs, food, anything for self-medication. And I think it's being able to also, that person have never really dealt with what made them cut in the first place. That's what's really necessary. Yes, safety, number one, is important. But two, we really have to explore and heal what is the trigger that made them want to cut. Why would they want to do that to themselves? And how can we provide them with a healthier way to deal with stress?
One of the things I wanted you to address also, Alexa, is about domestic violence, because it certainly is a very big issue today. But people don't really understand it, and it took me a long time to really understand it much better than I used to. And I would think, well, why is somebody staying in a marriage if somebody is beating her? And, of course, just like people were ignorant about our situation, saying, oh, she must have known he was gay before when she married him. She must have had low self-esteem. She was desperate for a husband. You know, they have a total misunderstanding of this whole situation. I think many people have a very big misunderstanding about domestic violence, thinking, well, if she's staying there, she must like to get hit, because that's kind of what the thinking is for a lot of people, when I, in fact, know that is not the case. That is not that easy to leave domestic violence. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely not. It's not easy at all to leave a domestic violence relationship. A lot of times when the person leaves, there's a high chance of that person being attacked, being physically lethal means towards them by the perpetrator, because that's the perpetrator's biggest fear, is abandonment. Even though it doesn't make sense, why are you beating your wife? Why are you hitting your wife? Why are you mistreating your wife? And then want to expect her to stay with you. That's how dysfunctional that is, but that is their biggest fear as a perpetrator, that you will abandon them. So when that fear comes that you actually leave, it is a very dangerous time for women when they leave. And they definitely don't need people who have no clue what's going on saying things like that. Oh, you must like to get hit. You know, what did you do to deserve it? Which is very, very upsetting and disturbing type of comments. And with domestic violence, a lot of times, these women don't even know that this is an abusive man. I think a lot of times, as I tell my clients, when you meet someone, just listen to them. Within the first 5 to 10 minutes of the conversation, they will tell you who you are, who they are. Listen to it. And if you start thinking, oh, I'll change that, I'm going to be able to fix that, he'd never do that to me, really start taking a second look and a step back, saying, what am I trying to make excuses for? I think a lot of times these abusers, they're good. They're good at what they do. They're good at grooming their victims. They're extremely charming. And when it's good, it's good. And when it's bad, it's bad. And the victims learn to live in those, the highs are high and the lows are low. So they don't even have time to heal or know what's going on, because they never know when the next crisis is going to begin.
And it's really sad, because I think that there's a certain personality problem with women who get into these situations. When I say that, I meant that they come from such dysfunction that the norm doesn't even come into their mind, that they're willing to settle for so little. I have a very wonderful friend that I met through the internet. Her name's, well, I'll give her name out later, but she has a book out, Look Me in the Eye. I'll announce it. Her name's Carol Park, C-A-R-Y-L. But it's a picture of a woman with a black eye on the cover, because she lives in South Africa, but you can get the book here. And it really attracted me when I first read it, because I didn't know a lot about domestic violence a few years ago. I knew that, you know, it wasn't something women want to get beat. You know, it's just a matter of circumstances of who you meet up with. And her story was just so compelling. I read that book, and I was like, I couldn't stop reading it, because I couldn't believe that she kept walking back into a situation where she would get beat up time and again by her ex-husband, or her husband at the time, but she would always forgive him. She would always feel, you know, you get fixated on that charming sociopathic narcissistic side that they present to you, and you keep thinking that's who they really are, but that's not who they are at all. That's just the act they put on. So even though you might get beaten down or you might get hit, you're still, if you love somebody, you're always hoping that they can change and you're going to be the one to, you know, get them to change. But that very rarely happens. I don't know if people have such large disorders that they really change. Do you find that to be true?
I honestly, I mean, I believe in miracles. I believe I see the good in everyone, but I have not seen in my years in practice a perpetrator of domestic violence change. I think they've learned how to calm down and reel themselves in from those acting out behaviors, but a lot of times they're a ticking time bomb, and it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that once that's somebody's nature, you really have to keep running away, because then eventually it can filter down to your children getting, you know, abused also. Or just seeing their mother getting abused is such a negative, toxic experience. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who had mothers who had domestic abuse, and their mother stayed there. They didn't leave. They were always trying to make a better life for their children, thinking, well, at least they have a mother and a father in the same place. You know, going back to the original thought that growing up in a toxic home, you know, or dysfunctional home, is just so destructive to a person, no matter how much you think that they don't know what's going on. Kids today are very smart and they're very perceptive, you know, much more so than when I was growing up. Today, there's so much stuff out there that you hear about everything. So when they see that their mother is being hurt or being belittled, you know, it's hurtful for that child. And, you know, I just think that they never quite come out of that, any kind of normal sense of what they should be doing in life. So I think that, yeah, you know, the issue of what about the children is so important, and I know that you've merely made great comments about that. The children need to grow up in a safe environment where they feel safe. And how do you handle these guys, though, who are so controlling? Now you're finally out of the marriage, but they just want to make your life miserable, so they'll take you to court. They'll take up all your legal, you know, make you spend money for legal expenses that you may not have, just so they can keep taking you to court and fighting you. Is there any way that you suggest women can handle that?
Yes. Well, they do that so they can still have access to you, even if they might not be able to speak to you or spew their garbage at you. They can just, they have conditioned the victim so much just by their presence in the room. The victim will start shaking and will start feeling that fear and that trauma. So I find it's making sure you have very strict boundaries with that other person. Make sure you really don't have contact with that person. And if there is contact, have supervised contact with a lawyer, a court officer, supervised visits for the children with a therapist, and really make sure, even if it's for a minute, don't underestimate the power of these perpetrators, these abusers, of what they can do within a minute. Even with a look or with a comment or with just a key word that they can say to you to destroy you, you really have to make sure they do not have any alone access to you, and that you always keep your distance, a safe distance from them.
Because they'll try to keep reeling you back if they can. And until you get to the point where you say, this is it, I don't want to hear from you, I don't want to know you, get away from me, I'm not answering your calls, you can do whatever you want, but you're not going to get to me. You know, and even that, of course, doesn't necessarily work, but you have to get to that mindset where you have to do that. And you always feel a sense of relief when you can do it. You know, it takes a strong woman to be able to do it. But to me, it takes more strength to be stuck in these relationships. I mean, to me, that's, as you said earlier, you're not living, you're just existing. And that's how I was, going day to day, every day waking up, getting out of bed and thinking, do I have to get through another day like this? And my heart was just always so broken, and I felt so broken as a person. And it started to make me doubt myself and my own self-confidence. My ability to raise my children, all these things were always thrown at me. Well, you're not a good mother. Well, you're not a good wife. You're not a good this. You're not a good that. And you hear these messages every day, and it's only a matter of time till you start believing them. And then a lot of times really difficult to get beyond that. So one of the things that you suggest in your book, because you have a lot of wonderful suggestions from each chapter, is how important it is for women to do journaling. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I find journaling really makes it real. When you write something down, and I like old-fashioned writing in a journal. I know everything now is dictating and speaking and putting it on the typing it into the computer. But really sit down with a pen and paper or a pencil and paper and write down. And don't judge yourself. Whatever comes out, comes out. Just write it all down. It's a way of also releasing all of that you've been carrying around with you, all the pain, the emotions, the ideas. And it's you, by putting it on paper, you're saying, this is documentation. And I know sometimes that doesn't make sense. Well, we know these things happened. But I've had so many clients come back to me and say, I didn't really get it, why you wanted me to write and journal. But now as I look back, I really realize, one, what I was going through, and two, how far I've come, and what these different mindsets. And now these are different things that we can work on in therapy. Of, I wonder why this was going on. Because I think, as you asked before, can you start healing when you're in an abusive, active abusive relationship? No, you're starting to survive. You don't have that time to reflect back on what's been going on in your life and how you address certain things. You can only do that when you're in a safe environment. And the journaling allows you to reflect in a safe way, to go back and forth, and to be able to kind of put all the puzzle pieces together.
And I think that's the whole key to it. You know, when you journal, you can look back and you can reflect back and you can see the things that have gone wrong. Because I think it's so important when you're going through negative experiences to write it down. Write it down so that you can remember it for the future. Because a lot of times there's so much going on in your head that you're trying to run away from it and not have to deal with it. Or it's going to get better. If I hang in here a little longer, he's going to see how important I am to him. You know, you have all these optimistic thoughts that just never happen. They never come true. So at least if you can look day by day or every few days and just see a pattern in your life, that even if it goes up for a day or two, it's going to be right back down there, aiming towards the bottom. That it's never going to stay up. It's never going to be a straight continuum of straight lines or lines going in an upward motion. At some point, they're all going to tank and go downhill. So that's why I think journaling is a great idea. Alexa, you have your own radio show on Blog Talk Radio. And when can people listen to it? Every Sunday night, right?
Well, it's every Wednesday night at 8 p.m.
Wednesday.
Yes, Insight into Healing.
And also you have your own television show now. This is not new for you, television, or, you know, you've certainly been an actress and have done many wonderful plays and shows, television. But now you have your own talk show on the station in Westchester, New York, that people can also access. Can you talk a little bit about your show and what people can listen for?
Yes, yes. It's called The Alexa Show, and I encompass all my different careers. I work also as a trainer and, as you said, as an actress. And what I do on my different shows is I hit those tough topics. I've had a lot of – the last couple of shows were – heroin overdose, suicide prevention. I go through the different topics, and I also like to bring people on the show who've had a journey of struggle in their life and how they came back and gave back to the society. And I shoot it in White Plains, New York. But anyone can watch it if you just type into your browser AlexaTVShow.com, and it will take you right to White Plains Community Media, and you'll be able to view all the shows there.
Yes, I'll put that on the link for this show, you know, in the next half hour so people can listen anytime they want. They can just hit into that and listen to the show, even if it's not live, right?
Yes, yes.
So also, you're in the process of coming out with another book maybe within this year, correct?
Yes, yes, I am. I'm working on my second book titled Your Walk in Life.
And what will that be about?
I will be building upon my first book, bringing it to the next stage of in my first book, I identified triggers, symptoms, behaviors, treatment plans. And now in this book, it's how to, once you've done that type of work, how do you start your walk in life with this definition of healing, of self-sense worth, of who you are, and also how to be in an environment and what type of environment you need to create for yourself in order to have a happy one, being able to have healthy people around you. setting boundaries and being able to use what's happened in your past as tools to strengthen you and build up your self-confidence as you move forward.
Are there any exercises you can give people before we end the show that they might start doing to help build up their self-esteem?
Yes. I think one, begin with positive affirmations. You can pick some on the internet, or you can have your own positive affirmations. I am good enough. I am worthy. I am a good person. And I think it's being able to really watch what you say to yourself. So really speaking to yourself in a positive manner. Also journaling. And I think also taking a look around your environment, people, places, and things, and see what's healthy and what's not healthy, and do all of this without judgment of yourself, and be able to start creating an environment for yourself where you can thrive in, not just to survive, because you deserve it.
And I think that's so important when you're going through these marriages and you're not out of them yet, and you can't really heal while you're living in this situation. But you can start your journey by starting with positive affirmations to yourself, and looking back at yourself before you were married and who you were then compared to who you are now. Because I know that I got very lost when I was married to my gay husband, you know, because of all the trickery and the, you know, all the abuse, the mental abuse, the gaslighting, which I call gay lighting in this situation. But, you know, all the mistakes and accusations that everything was always my fault because he was so unhappy because he wasn't living in the life that he was destined to live. But I really lost myself in that marriage, and people didn't recognize me anymore because I was just not who I used to be. So you have to think back to who you were before this marriage. And, you know, if you were feeling good about yourself, you know, you couldn't have been feeling bad about everything about yourself. Try to pull out those points that were good that you've now lost in your marriage to try to remember who you were before instead of being just living a life of existence, who you were when you were really living before. So do you think that's good advice too?
Yes, yes, definitely, because I think you bring up a great point. Women that are in these type of relationships, really, you're human. You want to see the best in everyone. That's a great quality to have, but not when you're in a domestic violence relationship or a verbally, emotionally abusive relationship. But take that and know that you have that innately in you, and don't let that be squashed for your next relationship or for when you leave this relationship, how you see what life is. Because I still want you to see the beauty of things, even though you've seen such horrific trauma for so many years, being able to take that and say, okay, there is beauty out there. I don't need to be treated like this. This has nothing to do with me, and this doesn't define me.
Well, I'm hoping the next time you come back to our show, Alexa, maybe you could help us a little bit with how to trust again after a destructive marriage. I think this is a problem that so many people face who have gone through this kind of trauma. And now they're either writing off men for good or I don't want a relationship ever again. You know, there many times, and that's fine if you feel really happy within yourself. I always tell women, learn to love yourself, and that could be good enough for a lot of women. But some women really want to get back into a relationship, but they're so afraid of trusting their own instincts because they made mistakes before. So maybe that's something we can talk about when you come back again. I would really appreciate
Definitely.
That. So to all of our women who are listening, thank Alexa so much. I love you, Alexa. You're the person I know who
too.
Is so beautiful on the outside and just as beautiful on the inside, so giving of yourself to all of us who need you. So thank you so much for being a guest again. Hopefully you can come back in the spring and we'll talk about some of these other issues. And to all of our women, you know, hold in there. People like Alexa are out there. If you need to get in touch with her, I'll have her contact information on this and also in our upcoming newsletter. So, Alexa, thank you so much again. I'm so proud to know somebody like you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on again.
My pleasure. I love you and love to all of our women, and we'll be talking to you again. Good night to everyone and have a wonderful week and take care. Bye-bye.